Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear James Corbett's speech from the conference in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, at the end of November 2012, called 9/11 Revisited, Seeking the Truth. The conference was sponsored by the Perdana Global Peace Foundation, and their website is perdanaforpeace.org, and that's the digit four, so perdanaforpeace.org. At the end of the speech, I'm going to tell you about a new book and about a breakthrough in the local media concerning 9/11. So let's begin with James Corbett of the Corbett Report.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is needless to say an honor to be presenting to you today in the company of General Tan Sri and Congresswoman McKinney and Mr. Gage. I wish to sincerely thank the Perdana Global Peace Foundation for its assembling such an esteemed panel on what I consider to be one of the defining geopolitical events of our era. The willingness to convene such a panel on the events of 9/11 and their continuing significance is to be heartily commended in this day and age where so many now consider 9/11 to be yesterday's news, even as it continues to play the role of the terrorist boogeyman hiding under the bed of global geopolitics. I've been asked to present to you today on the topic of what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, and as I'm sure you can imagine, I am humbled by the task of attempting to adequately present to you the thousands of pieces of evidence that would be needed to form any satisfactory answer to that very important question. Given the time constraints that we're operating under today, then, I trust that you will forgive me in limiting the scope of that investigation to a consideration of the actions and, perhaps more importantly, as we shall see, the inactions of those officials whose responsibilities make them most directly responsible for what happened at the Pentagon, not only on the day of September 11th, 2001, but in the months preceding and preceding the event. Specifically, I intend to examine today the areas of responsibility, the decisions taken, and the orders given by former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and former Vice President Dick Cheney on the day of 9/11. It is my contention that a thorough examination of these individuals and their actions on and around 9/11 will itself establish the basis for a potential criminal investigation into the 189 lives lost at the Pentagon that day. First, let's examine the actions of former Defense Secretary Rumsfeld. As the top-ranking executive officer in the Department of Defense, Rumsfeld was, on the morning of 9/11, as per U.S. Code Title 10, Section 113, second only to the President in the military hierarchy of the United States. Together with President Bush, Rumsfeld exercised the power of the National Command Authority, which includes joint control over the decision to launch a strategic nuclear weapons strike. Additionally, according to the 9/11 Commission's own final report, prior to 9/11, it was understood that an order to shoot down a commercial aircraft would have to be issued by the National Command Authority. By the 9/11 Commission's own account, we know that President Bush, attending an event at an elementary school in Sarasota, Florida, was effectively removed from decision-making during the hours of the attacks themselves. According to the official narrative of the attacks, the President did not have an open channel of communication with Washington, could not reach key officials for extended periods of time, could not maintain contact with the White House shelter conference room, did not talk to Vice President Cheney until 9:45, almost 10 minutes after Flight 77 hit the Pentagon, and did not talk to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld until after 10 a.m. Thus, Rumsfeld was, by default, the highest-ranking military authority in Washington that morning, and the only one with the authority to issue a shoot-down order during the time of the Pentagon attack. Given Secretary Rumsfeld's vital importance in the chain of command on 9/11, a careful study of his response to the attacks that morning are in order. The record of Rumsfeld's actions on 9/11 are well documented and themselves not a matter of controversy. This is Rumsfeld's own statement to the 9/11 Commission about his whereabouts that morning. Quote, On the morning of September 11th, 2001, I was hosting a meeting for some of the members of Congress. Ironically, in the course of the conversation, I stressed how important it was for our country to be adequately prepared for the unexpected. Someone handed me a note that a plane had hit one of the World Trade Center towers. Later, I was in my office with a CIA briefer when I was told a second plane had hit the other tower. Shortly thereafter, at 9:38 a.m., the Pentagon shook with an explosion of a then-unknown origin. I went outside to determine what had happened. I was not there long, apparently, because I am told I was back in the Pentagon with the crisis action team by shortly before or after 10 a.m. The implications of this statement alone are remarkable. By 9:05 a.m., 2 minutes after United Flight 175 hit the South Tower of the World Trade Center, it was generally understood among senior government officials that, in the infamous words of White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card, America is under attack. Yet at this time, the top-ranking military officer in the United States government, the only one in the loop that day with the ability to give the authority to shoot down hostile civilian aircraft, made no attempt whatsoever to coordinate a response to this acknowledged attack. He did not establish the details of the flights involved or possible other hostile aircraft with NORAD or the FAA. He did not make any effort to determine what interceptors, if any, had been launched in response to the two jets in New York. And he certainly did not issue any directions for intercepting any other potential aircraft. Instead, by his own account, he proceeded with a regularly scheduled meeting with his CIA briefer, Denny Watson. It's important to note that Rumsfeld actively deflected attempts by his staff to engage him in that crucial window of the time that Flight 77 was bearing down on the Pentagon. According to Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs Victoria Clark, she and other key DOD staffers had gone into Rumsfeld's office to, quote, tell him that the crisis management process was starting up. But Rumsfeld insisted that he needed to make a few phone calls and proceed with his regularly scheduled 9:30 briefing. Instead, he told Clark to wait for him in the Executive Support Center. During the entire time that Flight 77 approached the Pentagon, Rumsfeld proceeded with his business as usual. During this 35-minute window of time between the second strike on the Twin Towers and the crash of Flight 77 into the Pentagon at 9:38 a.m., the incalculably complex interlocking mechanisms of the most sophisticated defense system in the history of the world sprang into action. Counterterrorism Chief Richard Clark established a video conference to coordinate a crisis response to the attacks. The FAA Command Center issued a ground stop for all air traffic landing or transitioning through New York, Boston, Cleveland, and Washington air centers. The Northeast Air Defense Sector of NORAD launched F-15s to establish a combat air patrol over New York City. Yet throughout it all, the chief executive in command of the United States military in the president's absence sat in his office, giving no outward indication that he was aware of any of these activities and certainly making no effort to involve himself with any of them. Then, when the plane finally did hit the Pentagon, once again, the most important person in the military chain of command abandoned his post altogether, theoretically jeopardizing himself and demonstrably obstructing the military response to any other potential attackers, to participate in a meaningless photo opportunity on the lawn of the Pentagon, helping first responders to carry the wounded into an ambulance.
Secretary Rumsfeld was in his suite of offices on the other side of the building from the impact zone. He felt it, and he immediately was on the attack site within moments, much to the displeasure of his security people, but he did it. And there are pictures of the secretary helping other men carry stretchers of the injured.
At that point, it was still over 20 minutes before Rumsfeld would even talk to President Bush. And in that short communication, the decision of whether to issue a shoot-down order for further hostile aircraft was not even discussed. The issue of when and how that shoot-down order was eventually issued, or whether it was issued at all, is an extremely important one, but it lies outside the boundaries of our examination of the Pentagon today. But it is self-evident that Rumsfeld made no attempt to engage his shoot-down authority or even make himself available for a decision on the exercise of that authority during the first crucial hour of the attack on the United States. Nor can Rumsfeld claim ignorance of these issues. During the Reagan administration in the 1980s, both Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney were intimately involved with the creation of the very continuity of government operational protocols which were activated that day. The significance of this fact becomes even more apparent when we examine the actions of Vice President Dick Cheney during this same attack window. Unlike the whereabouts and actions of Rumsfeld during the lead-up to the attack on the Pentagon, the precise location of Vice President Dick Cheney and the timing of his movements are in considerable doubt. The 9/11 Commission itself slyly evades this question in their final report by noting, quote, "There is conflicting evidence about when the Vice President arrived in the emergency shelter conference room, aka the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, or PEOC. We have concluded from the available evidence that the Vice President arrived in the room shortly before 10 o'clock, perhaps at 9:58. The Commission left the heavy lifting of establishing this fact to a single footnote at the end of the report, where the evidence in favor of this conclusion is presented, including the PEOC log, Secret Service notes, and various testimony. What they do not address, however, is what the conflicting evidence of this timing indicated or how they addressed this conflicting evidence. One critical piece of that conflicting evidence came from former Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta, who testified to the Commission that the Vice President was already in the PEOC when he arrived at 9:20. And then, according to Mineta, about 5 or 6 minutes later, the following conversation took place between the Vice President and a young man in the PEOC.
During the time that the airplane coming in to the Pentagon, there was a young man who would come in and say to the Vice President, the plane is 50 miles out. The plane is 30 miles out. And when it got down to the plane is 10 miles out, the young man also said to the Vice President, do the orders still stand? And the Vice President turned and whipped his neck around and said, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? Well, at the time, I didn't know what all that meant. And
the flight you're referring to is
the flight that came into the Pentagon.
Pentagon. Yeah.
If true, this is exceptionally significant. This timeline and account completely counters the narrative of the 9/11 Commission and establishes an entirely different understanding of the air defenses that morning. According to the Commission, the government was not notified of Flight 77's approach until 9:36. Meaning there would have been no time for the confirmation of orders given in Mineta's account. In Mineta's version, the Vice President and others were monitoring as Flight 77 approached and finally hit the Pentagon. Yet no evacuation orders were given at the Pentagon. Defense Secretary Rumsfeld was not informed or contacted. Nothing at all was done to warn those in the building of the plane's approach. This is obviously not a trivial matter. So how did the 9/11 Commission address this discrepancy? By completely ignoring it. The Commission makes no mention of Mineta's testimony relative to the timing of Cheney's arrival in the PEOC, and the video of Mineta's testimony is not available on the Commission's publicly accessible video archive. Some have argued that Mineta is merely mistaken regarding the timing of what he witnessed. The Commission itself places the incident referred to by Mineta between the Vice President and the aide as taking place not at 9:25 as Flight 77 approached the Pentagon, but sometime between 10:10 and 10:15, implying that the entire incident was in fact referring to the approach of Flight 93, the last plane to be taken down that day. Mineta, for his part, has repeatedly told the exact same story with the exact same timeline in interview after interview over the years, often with remarkable levels of specific detail regarding the timing and the order of the events in question.
Some young man came in and said to the Vice President, there's a plane 50 miles out coming towards D.C. So I said to Monty Belger, who's the number two at FAA, I said, Monty, what do you have on radar on this plane coming in? He said, well, the transponder's been turned off, so we don't know who it is, and we don't know the altitude or speed. And so I said, well, where is it? He said, well, it's somewhere beyond Great Falls right now. And so Then the young man came in and said, it's 20 miles away. And so I'd say, well, Monty, where is this plane in relationship to the ground? And on radar, it's hard to associate with a ground point, but they'd be able to tell you roughly the distance from wherever you are. But he couldn't tell you speed or altitude. And then all of a sudden, as I was talking to him, he said, oh, I lost the bogey, lost the target. I said, well, where is it? He said, well, somewhere between Roslyn and National Airport. And about that time, someone broke into the conversation. He said, Mr. Secretary, we just had a confirmation from an Arlington County police officer saying that he saw an American Airlines plane go into the Pentagon. So then I said, Monty, bring all the airplanes down. When you see one of something happen, it's an accident. When you see two of the same thing happening, it's a trend, something. When you see three, it's a plan. So I said, bring all the planes down.
In the most stunning confirmation of this timeline, Mineta was directly questioned as to whether he may have been mistaken on the timing of Cheney's presence in the PIOC and the conversation with the aide, not by commission investigators, nor by journalists from the mainstream American news networks, but by independent grassroots citizens activists who talked to him after a speaking event.
My main concern is that in your testimony, you stated that Vice President Dick Cheney came into the office at 9:20 when you arrived, and he was already there. He's gone in front of Meet the Press, and he said that he was there at 9:38. Yet the 9/11 Commission report puts him there at 9:58 that morning.
58?
Yeah, I don't know if you got a chance to read it, but it puts him half an hour later. So I don't mean to ask a rhetorical question, but to the best of your recollection, was Vice President Dick Cheney already there at 9:20 when you arrived?
Yeah, I might have been mistaken on the 9:25, but he was already there. It wasn't 10.
It was 9:58. Yeah, that puts him 38 minutes later, which does not make sense to us at all.
No, I don't know how that comes about.
So, and I mean, it goes against your testimony, and it goes against his own testimony. I mean, the press, where he said he was there at 9:38, that's a full 38 minutes. So, to the best of your recollection, he was already there.
Oh, absolutely. And I think
given that there is no record of any kind for a shoot-down being issued by President Bush until 10:20 a.m., and given that Rumsfeld was, as we have seen, completely out of the loop, how could the orders referred to in Secretary Mineta's testimony be a shoot-down order? Only Bush and Rumsfeld, as National Command authorities, had the ability to issue such an order. Thus, what else can we infer about that order than that the Vice President's was confirming a stand-down order? This should not be a difficult story to independently corroborate. Surely all the commission had to do was confirm the details of this story with the aide himself. And as it turns out, they did. The aide in question was identified in 2010 by independent 9/11 researcher James Dorman as this man, Naval Aide and Vice Presidential Emergency Action Officer Douglas Cochran. According to the commission's own notes, Cochran was interviewed on April 16, 2004, but all details of that interview have been classified. Why have the details of that interview been classified? What information did it contain, and why can the public still not know that information now, 11 years after the events? The pattern that is forming in our investigation today is an ominous one indeed. It points to the deliberate hobbling of the air defense by a defense secretary who refused to involve himself in the response to the largest foreign attack on American soil in history. It also paints the disturbing picture of a vice president who watched as an airplane approached the very heart of the American defense establishment without so much as bothering to warn any of the personnel there. To what end would two of the highest-ranking officials in the United States government deliberately hinder, interfere with, or stand down the air defenses that morning? From the moment that Rumsfeld assumed office as head of the Pentagon, he was dealing with one of the greatest accounting scandals in the history of the government, and an inability to account for staggering sums of money in the Defense Department's budget. By the time he took over as defense secretary, a Defense Department audit of fiscal year 1999 found $2.3 trillion of transactions and adjustments were improperly accounted for. To understand the scope of the concern, a report from 2000 confirmed that the DOD had processed $7.6 trillion in department-level accounting transactions the previous year, with audit trails only capable of supporting $3.5 trillion of that. According to the department's own audits, $2.3 trillion of those entries were simply made up to make the accounts balance. Political pressures regarding the issue continued mounting throughout 2001, and Rumsfeld's Pentagon was under considerable pressure to get to the bottom of this issue. As a result, he gave a press conference on September 10th, 2001, announcing that the Pentagon was at war with a new enemy, bureaucracy. The very next day, Flight 77 crashed into the newly renovated wet wedge on the western side of the Pentagon. This is a picture of the location of the victims of the Pentagon attack that was released as part of the prosecution exhibits at the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui. It depicts the offices that were destroyed in the attack, including the office of Resource Services Washington, a team of 65 civilian accountants, bookkeepers, and budget analysts, 34 of whom died on September 11, 2001. As a Pittsburgh Post-Gazette article of December 20, 2001 noted, Robert Jaworski, the director of the office, was faced with the task of choosing which of his colleagues' funerals he would attend because he could not physically attend them all. The office's role in processing information regarding the unaccounted for $2.3 trillion has never been established by outside researchers and, in fact, has never even been inquired into by professional journalists. An Arlington County after-action report on the rescue and cleanup response at the Pentagon, however, notes that, quote, it was also the end of the fiscal year, and important budget information was in the damaged area. 9/11 researchers will see the parallels between this information and the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7, the 47-story steel-framed office tower that collapsed into its own footprint at 5:20 in the afternoon of 9/11, despite never having been hit by a plane. That building, too, housing the New York offices of the Securities and Exchange Commission, along with a host of government agencies, including the CIA, DOD, U.S. Secret Service, and others, was a repository of key financial records. Although the SEC did not reveal how many active investigations files were destroyed in the collapse of the building, Reuters and the LA Times estimated the number at 3,000 to 4,000, allegedly including documents pertaining to the Enron scandal. As for the $2.3 trillion unaccounted for in fiscal year 1999, it was followed by $1.1 trillion in fiscal year 2000. Such was the distraction that 9/11 provided from this particular issue that it virtually disappeared from the public spotlight overnight, aided by a Congress with an exceptional unwillingness to pursue the tough questions on this issue. A Congress, that is, with one notable and very courageous exception. So, you might already be familiar with this, but let's watch it again.
This is former Georgia Congresswoman and Green Party presidential candidate in 2008, Cynthia McKinney.
That's my first question. My second question, Mr. Secretary, according to the Comptroller General of the United States, there are serious financial management problems at the Pentagon, to which Mr. Cooper alluded. Fiscal year 1999, $2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, $1.1 trillion missing. And DOD is the number one reason why the government can't balance its checkbook. The Pentagon has claimed year after year that the reason it can't account for the money is because its computers don't communicate with each other. My second question, Mr. Secretary, is who has the contracts today to make those systems communicate with each other? How long have they had those contracts? And how much have the taxpayers paid for them? Finally, Mr. Secretary, after the last hearing, I thought that my office was promised a written response to my question regarding the four war games on September 11th. I have not yet received that response, but would like for you to respond to the questions that I've put to you today, and then I do expect the written response to my previous question, hopefully by the end of the week.
The second question, I've forgotten what the second question was.
I think Ms. Jonas knows it.
Okay.
This is, of course, not to suggest that September 11th was nothing more than an excuse to disguise financial fraud. There are any number of questions that need to be answered about what took place that day that point to many different, perhaps complementary explanations for some of the unresolved issues of 9/11, not least of which both Rumsfeld's and Cheney's participation, along with a host of top-ranking Bush administration officials, in a think tank called the Project for a New American Century, which produced a report 1 year in advance of the attacks, citing the need for a new Pearl Harbor to justify the enormous expenditures that would be required to maintain American global military hegemony into the 21st century. However, the issue of the budget analysis does, I posit, present a somewhat more plausible explanation for why that particular section of the Pentagon was targeted that day than the official narrative, which asks us to believe that Hani Hanjour, a pilot so incompetent that he was not allowed to rent a Cessna because of how poorly he flew on a test flight, decided to approach the Pentagon from the wrong direction before performing an 8,000-foot descending 270-degree corkscrew turn at 400 miles per hour to come exactly level with the ground, hitting the Pentagon in a mostly deserted, newly renovated wing of the Pentagon on the far side of the building from where Defense Secretary Rumsfeld and the Pentagon's top brass were sitting. In summation, any real investigation into criminal complicity in 9/11 would have to look at the issue of the movements, actions, and inactions of Defense Secretary Rumsfeld and Vice President Cheney on that day. Any such investigation would proceed by, one, establishing the reasoning behind Rumsfeld's complete abdication of his command responsibilities in the midst of a full-scale attack on the country, as well as the failure of all subsequent investigations to pursue this line of inquiry or to hold him accountable for his inaction. Two, establishing the nature of the discrepancy between the official estimate of Cheney's arrival at the PEOC and Mineta's account, including requiring the official, public, on-the-record, under-oath testimony of Cheney and Bush about what occurred that morning, something that I will parenthetically add the 9/11 Commission did not do. Number three, the declassification of Douglas Cochran's testimony and all other relevant testimony from the 9/11 Commission's archives, and, where necessary, taking that testimony again in a more impartial manner than that conducted by the Commission. I regret that I've only been able to scratch the surface of the evidence pointing to the criminal action and inaction of the officers responsible for what happened on 9/11 in the limited time that we have here today, but I would, however, like to once again extend my sincere thanks to the Perdana Global Peace Foundation for organizing this conference and encouraging further inquiry into these events. For if Orwell's ominous dictum that he who controls the past controls the future is indeed true, then it is my profound conviction that an honest criminal investigation into the true complicity and cover-ups at the heart of 9/11 will afford us a chance to steer the world of the next 10 years towards peace, justice, and reconciliation, just as assuredly as the refusal to pursue that investigation has steered the world toward war, injustice, and suffering for the previous 10 years. Thank you.
And again, you were just listening to James Corbett of the CorbettReport.org speaking at the conference called 9/11 Revisited, Seeking the Truth, that took place in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia in November of 2012. I recommend that you check out his website, thecorbettreport.org. And now for the book. The 9/11 Toronto Report has just been released in book form. Here's what it says on the back cover. This volume is the final report issued from the international hearings on the events of September 11, 2001, held in Toronto, Canada. Over the 4 days of the Toronto hearings, noted authors and scientific experts presented the best evidence gathered in the previous decade that refutes the official account of 9/11 to a panel of distinguished individuals whose opinion on the strength of the evidence should carry considerable weight in the public sphere. The opinions of the Toronto hearings panelists and supporting experts' reports presented in this volume make a clear and unmistakable case that the official account of 9/11 is false, and that the only way to realize truth and accountability is to tear down the wall of secrecy and lies that has been erected by the United States government around the events of September 11. The book was published by the International Center for 9/11 Studies and was edited by James Gourley. And again, the book is called The 9/11 Toronto Report. I encourage you to get yourself a copy. And now some good news. Apparently the 9/11 truth signs that have been painted on bridges, etc., around the Hartford area have sparked Channel 61, that's Fox 61, to interview one of our local 9/11 truth activists. The interview took place on Tuesday, December 11th. Perhaps you can view it by going to the Fox 61 website. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.